Hi, welcome to Mind the Disruption. I'm Bernice Yanful. I'm a PhD student and public health practitioner working to move knowledge into action for better health for everyone. On this podcast, I chat with community organizers, public health professionals, academics, and more who have a key thing in common: they're disruptors. They're people who refuse to accept things as they are, passionate about health for all, and are pursuing it with a tenacity, a courage, and a deep conviction that a better world is possible. In season one, we're talking about creative discontent, what it means to look around us, see something that needs to be changed, something that is unfair, unjust, and then taking bold action despite the resistance we might face. In each episode, we hear from a disruptor who has done just that in different areas: work, food, whiteness, migration, and much more. And we hear their personal journeys. Then we dive into a reflective conversation about what all this means for public health. Wherever we find ourselves, in research, policy, or practice, how do we break from the status quo and move forward with boldness?
This podcast is made and brought to you by the National Collaborating Center for Determinants of Health. We support the public health field to move knowledge into action to reduce health inequities in Canada. We're hosted by St. Francis Xavier University. We're funded by the Public Health Agency of Canada. And we are one of six National Collaborating Centers for Public Health working across the country. The views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of our funder or host. We are located in Mi'kma'ki, the ancestral and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
There has been an injustice that's occurred, and that an injustice or a series of injustices that have allowed some people to have food and allowed other people to struggle for access to food. So if we're going to respond to this issue, we must also acknowledge, respond, and dismantle the oppressive organizing principles that impact people's ability to eat.
That was Paul Taylor, our main guest for today's episode. Paul is an anti-poverty activist, teaches at Simon Fraser University, and is the co-founder of Evenings and Weekends Consulting. From 2017 until January 2023, he was the executive director of FoodShare Toronto, Canada's largest food justice organization working to advance access to food for all. The work FoodShare does is vast. It supports urban farms. It works to increase access to affordable produce through good food markets, and it advocates for the right to food at local and national levels, among many, many other things. All underpinned by a desire to dismantle the barriers that constrain people's access to food on their own terms, especially for groups most affected by food insecurity and poverty, including Black and Indigenous peoples, people of color, and people living with disabilities. During Paul's time with the organization, it became further cemented as an innovator, known for its path-breaking work. In my conversation with Paul, we talk about one such way that FoodShare has challenged the status quo, through its Body Liberation and Fat Acceptance Statement. In a nonprofit world where food-based organizations may feel pressure to implement programs focused on body size and weight as a condition of receiving funding, FoodShare has gone in a different direction. It affirms that all bodies are worthy and have a right to exist as they are, and refuses to participate in projects that suggest the opposite, those rooted in health-harming narratives and practices around fatness and a thin ideal. FoodShare's stance reflects who Paul has been as a leader: resolute, firm in his values, and with the larger picture in mind, the well-being of the communities with whom he works. My conversation with Paul, which was recorded prior to him leaving the organization, explores his journey in becoming the executive director of FoodShare, how the Body Liberation and Fat Acceptance Statement came about, and its connections to the organization's larger mission of food justice. Then, for the reflective conversation, I speak with registered dietitian Lillian Lee Yin. Lillian and I discuss the health harms of attitudes and systems that discriminate against people living in larger bodies, and her desire to contest weight bias and discrimination through her work. Together, Paul and Lillian show that food justice is not just about who has access to food and in what quantities, but is so much more. It is about the relationships we hold to food, our bodies and our cultures, as well as our relationships with each other and the world around us. It is about working to dismantle systems of oppression, including colonialism, racism, and white supremacy, that shape not only how food is produced, distributed, and consumed, but also the value we assign to ourselves and others based on body size and weight. Ultimately, food justice is about social justice. It means advancing everyone's right to a dignified life in which access to food that enables people to thrive is an essential resource for living and critical to public health. Paul told me about how his early life experiences created a lifelong commitment to advancing equity and justice. You've written extensively about growing up materially poor in Toronto and how that shaped a desire in you to challenge different forms of oppression. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about that. How did your early experiences influence what you aspire to do and who you hope to be?
So for me, it wasn't until, you know, I was about 13 years old when, you know, I was living in Ontario, I still am. A premier was elected, Mike Harris, under the guise of the Common Sense Revolution. And one of the things he did that had an impact on our family was he cut welfare by 22%.
Yeah.
And for me, as a 13-year-old raised by a single mom, a powerful Black woman, you know, for me, it was really transformative. That was the first time I saw my mother cry. Shortly after that cut, we lived without electricity, without heat, without hot water for large portions of my childhood. You know, I think the one thing that I took from, well, I took many things from that experience, but one thing that I took from that experience was recognizing that actually it wasn't something that my mother had done. It wasn't something that I had done. It wasn't something that poor families had done to deserve less food or to navigate the kind of pressure that they were forced to navigate, but it was a political decision. Living in poverty, that's what really opened my eyes to the systems that control and impact so many of our lives. So I think it's from that point on that I really started to try to understand and seek opportunities to challenge those systems that not only cause people to be poor and hold people in poverty, but that tell them that they are bad and less deserving.
Yeah. So you grew up in circumstances that made you see the injustice at the root of those circumstances. And as you said, it kind of propelled you to want to do something about them. And so what did those early opportunities or that early work that you were engaged in look like?
I would say the early opportunities came for me in the classroom, in the fact that I wasn't treated like a lot of other Black boys that looked like me. Mm-hmm. And I think that had a lot to do with the way that I spoke. And it's a real reminder of the kind of deeply embedded oppression that exists within systems like education. Mm-hmm. But I was, you know, had some privilege. And what that meant was that, you know, teachers saw me. Teachers saw that I had potential. Hmm. Teachers saw that I had capacity. And ultimately, it meant that they taught to me. Unlike people who had all of the same things, capacity, potential, and brilliance, but didn't get taught to because of the messaging that those teachers are told about Black boys and about what's possible for us. So I think that's where some of those opportunities came for me as a result of some privilege.
Right.
But also as a result of the hard work of a Black woman, my mother. You know, this is work that many Black women, especially the parents of Black boys, have to take on, challenging the low expectations that society bestows on Black children and in particular Black boys. Mm-hmm. So those, for me, having a mother that recognized and was willing to challenge that consistently, having teachers that, you know, as a result of my privilege, taught to me, those were some of my early experiences that led me to believe that I could do things and that my experience was valid and valued, you know.
And can you tell me a little bit more about that privilege? You had mentioned it's because of the way that you spoke and it was different from the other Black boys in your classroom.
So I grew up just off Lansdowne in the West End of Toronto, where people were coming from all over the world And I also had a babysitter that liked to watch soap operas. So at an early age.
Which one?
It was the Young and the Restless.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Young and the Restless.
Yeah. Young and the Restless. So I grew up, you know, with one of my teachers being Victor Newman and all of the other, the cast of characters on the Young and the Restless as I sat with my babysitter. Mm-hmm. And I realized in retrospect that, you know, that was also a classroom for me. I learned how people were speaking. I learned how people were moving through the world. And it invited me into a way of moving into the world that is largely the way, you know, I think privileged white folks move through the world. And with an invitation to do so.
Paul went on to become a classroom teacher, inspired by early experiences tutoring young Black boys in his school, who he told me were celebrated for their basketball skills, but often forgotten and ignored in the classroom, their academic potential going unrecognized. For Paul, teaching has always been about creating spaces where people feel centered and like they belong. And while Paul loved teaching, he also had a desire to tackle the wider systems producing inequities and recognized that he could support learning in many different ways. So he decided to pursue other work. Before becoming the executive director of Food Share, he worked at a shelter for youth experiencing homelessness in Toronto and two neighborhood houses in BC, where his curiosity in how systems could be redesigned to promote equity grew. This curiosity eventually brought Paul to Food Share, a decision driven largely by his interest in tackling poverty.
I often admit that food, although I like to eat it, I like to cook it, I like to buy it, I like to touch it, it's not the thing that gets me up in the morning,
okay.
Although sometimes it feels like it is with coffee. But, you know, really my passion is around anti-poverty, challenging the existence of poverty and the inequities that are deeply embedded in our society. And I feel like food has provided, you know, a really interesting opportunity to engage in conversations about inequities, about poverty, mm-hmm. and about the ways in which these things have been poorly misunderstood, poorly diagnosed, or, you know, we've collectively responded in ways that are not ultimately the most helpful, and truly what can be done. So, yeah.
And so what drew you to Food Share in particular? Did you see it as an opportunity to kind of use food as a tool to address some of those issues that you were passionate about?
Exactly. Yeah, I would say, you know, Food Share is an organization in across the country and maybe even beyond that has an incredible reputation for innovation, for developing food-based programs, community-based food-based programs and initiatives and models. Mm-hmm. But I actually was curious about Food Share because I was curious about Food Share's approach to lead with food, when for me, these were issues that were not about food and that I personally feel leading with food can be a bit of a distraction.
Oh, interesting.
A distraction away from the systemic issues that affect who has food and who doesn't. Things like anti-Black racism, colonialism, ableism, white supremacy. So for me, what really interested me in Food Share was the ability to have deep conversations and be curious about food and how we use food as an organization. So I think we've been able to collectively be curious in a way that shifted our approach in that, yes, we deal with food, but we're always talking about the systems around food that cause people to either have food or not.
Yeah. And in Canada, many households lack access to food. According to Statistics Canada data, approximately 16% of households were food insecure in 2021, meaning they lacked the ability to afford food at some point during the year. Across the country, the burden of food insecurity is not distributed equally. Some groups, including Black and Indigenous peoples, racialized groups, and people with disabilities, are made more vulnerable to food insecurity due to the combined and interacting effects of systemic racism, exclusion from food policy decision-making, and economic oppression, among other factors. Studies show that food insecurity is an important determinant of health with serious implications for health and well-being. According to research summarized by Proof, an interdisciplinary research program studying household food insecurity in Canada, food insecurity increases vulnerability to poor oral health, various infectious and chronic diseases, and depression and anxiety disorders, among a host of other conditions, making food insecurity an urgent public health issue. For FoodChair, a focus on food justice is central to addressing food insecurity, because it's not only about a lack of food, but the unjust systems that create food insecurity in the first place. I asked Paul to expand on what food justice means to him and what it means for the work of the organization. I wanted to shift a little bit and talk about FoodChair's approach to food justice. So I've done a little bit of teaching around food and food systems. And in my courses, we spend a lot of time talking about terminology and how the language we use is not just semantics. It has important implications for how we understand the problem we're trying to address, as well as possible solutions. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, FoodChair positions itself as a food justice organization. Can you tell me a little bit about that? How do you understand food justice?
At the root of this issue around food insecurity is an injustice. That's where I begin, that there has been a series of injustices that have allowed some people to have food and allowed other people to struggle for access to food. So if we're going to respond to this issue, we must also acknowledge, respond, and dismantle the oppressive organizing principles that impact people's ability to eat. So it opens up a whole host of conversations when we have a justice lens around who should be designing the interventions, who should be leading the interventions, who should be paid and resourced to be able to test things, try things, dream. In this country, we see, you know, the largest organizations doing work around food are headed by white folks. Yeah. And if they have really, really, really big budgets, well, then they're headed by white men. And for us, that is a reflection of the injustice that seems to have been baked into society. We want to work with people who understand the urgency of these inequities and the lived reality of navigating these inequities so that they can be resourced to lead.
Absolutely. A lot of what you're saying reminds me of the book Black Food Matters. Have you read that book before?
Yes, I haven't gotten through the entire book, but I do have it on my shelf.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's fantastic. And one of the things that I found most interesting is in a chapter by Hannah Garsh, she distinguishes between three different approaches to food justice. So a punitive approach being interventions that are often rooted in a charity model and this notion of helping the poor. So, for example, efforts to improve the nutrition of particular groups that teaches often low-income people how to eat, what to eat, when to eat, et cetera, and demonizes foods that have cultural significance. And then there's a policy-oriented approach that seeks to create kind of incremental change by working within existing food systems and promoting policies that help move towards a more like healthy, affordable, and sustainable food system. And finally, there's a more radical grassroots justice approach that really seeks to address the underlying forms of structural violence and oppression, creating a lack of access to food in the first place, and seeks to connect to issues beyond food. So I'm curious, how does the work that FoodChair does, how is it positioned among those different approaches?
That's a good question. I think it's a complicated question in that FoodChair is a charity.
Sure.
So, you know, there are still external forces, factors, policies, laws that affect how we do our work. As an individual, I can say I'm not interested in the first two descriptions that you described. I'm not interested in any type of activity that tries to teach low-income people how to cook.
Right.
That's a huge miss and offensive. Low-income people, just because someone, you know, we all know this, but just because someone's low-income doesn't mean that they don't know how to cook. They just can't buy the food that they need.
Right.
I also think a lot of policy conversations, whether it's basic income or what have you, are all go-forward approaches. And only some of us in society have the privilege of a go-forward approach. It's like developing a policy that says, this point on, we're going to have a basic income for everybody.
Mm.
You know, that's all fine and well. But what about the intergenerational, long-lasting harm that's been caused by systems that cause, for example, Black and Indigenous folks to get paid less,
right,
have less food? The costs and the impacts of those things are real. And we can't just say, let's move forward doing this. We need to have some reconciliation before we can say, let's go forward in how we address poverty and food insecurity. So not interested so much in go forward approaches that don't talk about things like reparations and other forms of restitution, because for me, those are the only ways that we can move forward. I'm not interested in policy windows because I think there's smoke and mirrors. You know, we can focus on trying to advocate for a basic income, while the whole time what we're seeing is housing prices skyrocket. We're seeing food prices skyrocket. So we can fight for a $2,000 basic income, right, all the while the forces that are extracting the most profit from us, they are continuing to do so, so much so that the amount that we've been fighting for is no longer effective.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah.
I'm interested in frameworks that advance a decent quality of life for us all.
Next, I ask Paul about FoodShare's Body Liberation and Fat Acceptance Statement that outlines its commitment to affirm all bodies in its work. So I wanted to move to discussing FoodShare's Body Liberation and Fat Acceptance Statement. Where did the idea and the felt need for such a statement come from?
This is something that many of my colleagues have been championing within the organization for a long time. I think the impetus, one, encouraging by our colleagues to say we need a public stance on this, and there's an opportunity for us to help inspire organizations to also be critical of these kind of harmful narratives. But also recognizing that we're doing work around food and that people are reaching out to us all the time with sometimes really wild requests. And we don't want to leave it to the facilitator of a program to feel like they have to make a decision for the organization on some of these things that can be really, really harmful. So we decided to, you know, take a public stance on not wanting to do work inspired by trying to change people's bodies, not wanting to do work based on ideas, science that has already been acknowledged as causing disproportionate harm to the communities that are also the communities that are most likely to experience food insecurity, the communities that are navigating systems that exclude them from access to food. So if our allegiance is to those communities, this is the kind of position that makes sense for FoodShare to be taking. And what we've found is that a number of organizations are really interested in food work, food justice work, from a body liberation and fat acceptance lens. You know, originally we used to call this body positivity. But it's not about being positive about our bodies. It's about being liberated from the kind of oppressive ways that, whether we're doing food work or not, that society talks about fat people.
The statement released in 2021 reads in part,
as a food justice organization that believes in body liberation and fat acceptance, we do not support fat phobia in any of its forms, including where it intersects with systems of oppression, such as white supremacy, settler colonialism, colorism, ableism, ageism, misogyny, queerphobia, classism, etc. Because we know that access to food is shaped by these systems, as well as people's current material conditions and their lived experiences. We respect people's choices on the foods they eat. We are challenging the idea that foods are good or bad, or that people are good or bad for eating certain foods.
Can you talk a little bit about how this statement connects with the larger mission of FoodShare to advance food justice? What do you see as the connections between this type of statement and food justice?
Well, I think the big one is recognizing that it's not about changing bodies and that all bodies have a right to exist as they are. And I think lots of organizations will go into the doing of stuff that they think they ought to do, especially around food, whether it's community kitchens, compost, workshops and the like, without that really clear bird's eye view of the systems that affect our work. And we know that fat phobia and ableism are systems that affect our work. And if we're not able to shine a light on those things and then design our interventions in a way that mitigates the harm that has been caused, well, then we're not designing effective programs.
And you mentioned the term fat phobia. How do you understand fat phobia?
Yeah, I think about it as the harm that our society and individuals within it causes to people with bigger bodies. You know, I think about it in the ways that, you know, when many of us are watching movies, how fat folks are positioned as the joke.
Sure.
In the movies, are positioned as hapless. Mm-hmm. You know, these are all really, really harmful things.
As Paul is saying here, many popular films and TV shows often portray fatness as a moral failing, make characters living in larger bodies the butt of the jokes, or advance harmful stereotypes related to laziness and a lack of intelligence. But fat phobia, sometimes referred to as anti-fatness, not only exists in movies. It is embedded in our everyday lives, our policies and systems, including in public health. For example, in anti-obesity campaigns that promote weight loss focused on individual behavior change, campaigns that research shows may have negative impacts on eating behaviors. Later, Lillian and I chat further about the potential health harms of such forms of bias and discrimination.
The assumption that somebody who has a bigger body is trying to have a smaller body, you know, that is a harmful assumption. Mm-hmm. The idea that we would say to someone, oh my goodness, you look so great because they've lost weight.
Right.
Is based on an assumption rooted in fat phobia, this fear and hatred for fatness. You know, this permeates our society. And I think there's so many ways that we use language to reinforce fat phobia. Yeah, so that's how we see it. And that's how we think about how important it is to acknowledge, respond, and dismantle it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And connected to that statement, you have a policy for partnerships and funders that explicitly states as an organization, you will not participate in projects or coalitions that track or reference body size. What has been the reaction to this policy from your funders and from other potential partners?
Yeah, some folks lean in
okay.
and want to be a part of that. Most folks lean in and want to be a part of the conversation or seize an opportunity to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks, I'm sure, think we're out to lunch.
Okay.
But those are the folks that we have no time for. They can, you know, do the things that make them happy and donate to the places that make them feel
sure.
good. And then others who, you know, we've been a little shocked by in that they have been invited into the conversation. We've reached out to them to say, we can't work with you despite your request because of these things. We've initiated a desire to work with them around challenging fat phobia within their organization and the way that they're designing programs. And some groups just demonstrate that their allegiance is to their profiles, building larger organizations, and their funders, because even though they are hearing that this is harmful stuff, they are deciding to prioritize the funder that feels like it's a good project. So that part has been really disappointing for us in the space. And I've seen some really close partners or folks that we hope to work closely with double down on practices that we know are fat phobic and that are not in line with our body liberation and fat acceptance stance. So we've had to withdraw from coalitions.
Oh,
we've
wow.
had to decline funding. We have had to decline partnerships, decide not to apply for funding because this is just so important to us, because mm-hmm. it's so important to the people that we have an allegiance to.
Mm-hmm. And what has been the impact of that, having to, like you mentioned, withdraw from coalitions, decline funding? Has that threatened the health or the sustainability of the organization, or have you been able to find other ways to make sure that you can
nope,
continue
it
going.
Hasn't.
Oh, it hasn't.
Because we just keep it moving.
Yeah.
You know, we just keep it. There's lots to do. You know, we can't work with everybody on everything. And what it has done, I think, has made our organization more sustainable and stronger. Again, because the people that we have an allegiance to are seeing that we have an allegiance to them. And not just listening to them on an ad hoc basis, but actually, you know, taking the things that we're hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And applying that to all of our work.
And you also mentioned that as an organization, you've offered to provide some sort of training or information around these issues that concern you. So fat phobia, anti-fatness, et cetera. Have organizations, partners, potential funders taken you up on that offer?
Yeah. My colleagues have hosted workshops that have been incredibly well attended, nice. Lots of positive feedback, lots of good conversation, and a real desire from, you know, I would say the vast majority of organizations to continue to seek opportunities to embed principles of body liberation and fat acceptance into their own work and to seek guidance from us and from the task force that we struck, internal task force that we struck of staff and board members that looked at body liberation and fat acceptance and helped us come up with our statement.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like maybe you've had to decline some funding, some partnerships, but new opportunities have come up in their place.
Absolutely. And the only thing that we've missed out on sometimes is money, but it's just money after all.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to get into a little bit of the language of the actual policy. And something that struck me is a section where it says that FoodShare will proceed with caution when funders state their work is about healthy choices or good health. What is it about that type of phrasing that gives you and your team pause?
Yeah, because when a funder is defining good health, especially a funder or an organization that's white-led or predominantly white, we got to proceed with caution if they are starting to define what good health means. You know, we are the experts in our bodies, and we are the ones who can best describe what good health is for us. So definitely having some pause and caution when there's an organization or institution purporting to want to focus on good health, mm-hmm. Especially if they haven't had conversations with individuals navigating poverty and food insecurity around what good health means to them.
So kind of these externally imposed ideas of what good health is. Yeah.
And often when these groups often think about health and they prioritize physical health. But for us, we recognize, hey, if somebody is thousands of miles away from home and they want to eat something that's deep fried and delicious because it makes them feel like closely connected to home, mm-hmm. and that's going to have a huge impact on their mental health, eat that deep fried deliciousness, kale chips or kale is not the solution to all the things and for all the people. So recognizing that food is cultural. Food is about more than nourishing our bodies. It's about a whole host of other things that are important to consider that people are considering when they're thinking about what to eat and what not to eat.
And I think a lot of the interventions that tend to be most conventionally implemented with respect to healthy eating are based on assumptions that people don't know like what's healthy for them, or they can't make their own decisions, right? And it's all of these, all of these false stereotypes or stigmatizing language that really does not serve to tackle what's at the root of the issues and some of the different forms of oppression that are operating.
It's so true. And I think about how no more evident is it than in Canada's most recently released food guide. Mm-hmm. Where they, stress the benefits of eating fruits and vegetables. They talk about water over sugary soft drinks. Mm-hmm. Nothing about boil water advisories.
Sure, yeah.
Nothing about access, that fruits and vegetables are actually, the price of those things are going up faster than the costs of meat, making them more and more inaccessible for folks. So it feels strange. It's like telling Canadian folks across the country to, make sure you wear a seatbelt in your car while you're driving, but your car doesn't have a seatbelt, So what we need is to make sure the governments are doing what they can to make sure that people can make healthy choices for themselves and keep safe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how does this notion of health figure into the work that FoodShare does? And so you're cautious about seeking funding where funders are talking about promoting good health, et cetera. But for you as an organization, how do you understand health and how does that connect to the work that you do?
I don't know if we've had an organizational conversation about how we think about health, but I know for me as an individual, I think the way that we've been taught to think about health is deeply problematic. Mm-hmm. I think what we allow to be called healthcare is actually a sick care system. Yeah, a sick care system that stops at your neck. So your eyes, if you have a problem with your eyes, sorry, eyes don't count. Mm-hmm.
Teeth,
sorry. Health, mental health care, sorry. So, to call it a healthcare system is like the most gigantic stretch I've heard in a long time.
Yeah.
So the way that I think about things like food and food justice is that's healthcare. Mm-hmm. Healthcare shouldn't be divorced from access to affordable, culturally appropriate, nourishing food. It shouldn't be divorced from access to housing. That's healthcare. So I would love to see healthcare strategies and frameworks that include housing for all, food for all, and all of those pieces, not this preoccupation with policy windows and single policies that in vacuums can actually end up doing nothing. When I was fortunate enough to go to Rome to the Food and Agricultural Organization.
Oh, nice.
To be a part of a consult around the right to food and how what the right to food looks like in Canada. And I will never forget sitting next to a boss, the delegate from Sierra Leone, who after I spoke, he looked at me almost thinking I was lying. He thought I was, you know, talking about food insecurity in Canada, a rich country, mm-hmm. you know, saying, how could this exist? You know, I told a story about one of my neighbors, you know, going through garbage bins and finding some cooked chicken wings that he then ate. And he was just stunned. Like, how could this be in one of the richest countries in the world? What are we working towards? What are we trying to do if that's what's happening in the rich countries? Is that what we want to be? We're not living up to our potential. And to me, our potential is about making sure that we can all thrive.
And this desire to enable everyone to thrive is the main driving force behind all the work FoodShare does, including with the release of the Body Liberation and Fat Acceptance Statement. The statement recognizes that the fat phobia and anti-fatness permeating popular culture, health and wellness spaces, and so much more is an issue of injustice, and that a commitment to food justice requires that they be dismantled and body liberation be advanced in their place. You can learn more and read the full statement by visiting the FoodShare website, foodshare.net. The website also provides links to additional resources on advancing body liberation and fat acceptance in various spaces, including public health. Amid the challenging work Paul and the organization as a whole have done to confront the status quo, including through the statement and beyond, I wanted to learn more about how he handles the pushback he receives. He tells me about the importance of acting with integrity and keeping the bigger picture at the forefront of everything he does.
I try to always act with integrity and ethically. I try to do what I think is the right thing to do. I try to create space to listen and hear from others, and certainly a willingness to change course if I'm learning that something that I've been involved in a decision around is not helpful. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I don't have a lot of time for pushback that isn't centered on advancing equity and justice. So, for example, organizations, from what I've heard, FoodShare included at one point, was unwilling to have pointed conversations about white supremacy and its impacts. Mm. That unwillingness to have conversations about white supremacy and its impacts is not work that I, you know, need to take on.
Sure.
White supremacy is real. Its impacts are far-reaching.
Yeah.
So I'm going to keep it moving with that understanding. I'm really thoughtful about how my energies are going to be used, and that's not how I'm going to use my energies. So if there are people that don't think that we should be paying for interviews for whatever reason, you know, I know that we're doing this work because we're valuing people's labor, whether they work for us or not. Mm-hmm. And that what we've heard from our colleagues, our prospective colleagues, is that is the right thing to do. That's a really important piece for us when it comes to acting ethically and integrity. It's who do we have an allegiance to? Is it our donors? Is it large institutions that may provide us funding? No, it's not. They are just providing one of the inputs to the work. Mm-hmm. And when I get emails from one of our members of our advisory committee, where we prioritize people with lived experience and poverty, that says, why are we doing this? That is far more important than any email from a funder that says anything, because it's about who we're working for and how we keep that front and center in all that we do. Mm,
I love that. I think for me, I scare a little bit too easy. So I think sometimes in the face of pushback or resistance, I'm a little too quick to change course. So it's really interesting to hear you speak about the importance of having that larger picture in mind about who you're working for, who you're working with, and making sure that's at the forefront of the decisions that you're making rather than being beholden to the desires and wishes of your funders. I think that's so important.
It's easy because it can be scary, you know? Yeah, it can be scary, those calls from funders where they're saying they want this or they want to see that. And we've actually said no to funding.
Okay.
Yeah, we've said no to funding because we just didn't feel like it aligned with our work.
And finally, I asked Paul to reflect on the journey he's had with this work and what advice he would lend to others looking to challenge the usual ways of thinking and doing in the spaces in which they find themselves. I'm curious to hear from you what has surprised you the most during your journey. So from a teacher, anti-poverty activist, the food justice leader, what has been surprising to you in this work?
I think how little support there is for Black leaders, for racialized leaders who are now being called, you know, to lead organizations as a result of what some have described as a racial reckoning. You know, a lot more racialized leaders are being tapped to run organizations. But what we don't always think about is that these organizations are they have deep histories of hurt, of trauma, of white supremacy, of all kinds of things that now racialized leaders are not only inheriting, but there's a new expectation. There's an expectation that organizations are shifting. And we're asking the people who have been most harmed by systems to know how to shift the systems that we didn't create, that we don't benefit from. And there's a lot of pressure to do that.
When you transitioned into the role of executive director, did you feel like you got the support that you needed?
Oh, definitely not.
No.
I had to, I worked really hard to connect with others working in the food space who were racialized. Yeah, brought together racialized folks working in this food space without an agenda, just to get together. And that, to me, was one of the most healing and important things that I ever did, because we got to, you know, recognize that we're not the only ones going through this nonsense, you know?
Yeah.
And really build community around that and to some extent build power. So that for me has been and continues to be, you know, one of the most helpful and beneficial things that I've ever done in my leadership at FoodShare. And I hope that it's had the same impact for others.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about advice you might have for other folks who are looking to challenge the status quo in whatever spaces they find themselves. I was reading your activist manifesto online, and in it, you mentioned the importance of starting with curiosity rather than a goal. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a good one. Why I say lean into curiosity is that's, you know, I've just consistently asked myself questions. You know, my mother asked me, she told me that it was okay to say why, much to her chagrin, maybe, but, you know, and everybody else's now, that it's okay to ask why. Why do we do this? Why is this like this? Does it have to be like this, you know? And just that curiosity is what's going to lead to greater understanding, which is going to lead to hopefully change, the more power we're able to access or inspire. So I see a lot of what some would call well-intentioned white folks jumping on to, you know, some of this kind of work and some of the language. And sometimes it feels like they are just doing that to be disruptive, or they're just doing that to demonstrate their wokeness or connection to Blackness and indigeneity. So I think curiosity is the thing that I've found most useful.
So in addition to being curious, do you have any other advice for people who are looking to challenge the way things are being done?
I guess I would say take care of yourselves, you know? That is so important. And only we are the best at knowing what we need to be healthy. So I encourage people to take care of themselves. This work can be draining. This work can be lonely. It can be isolating. It can be risky. So, you know, make sure you're prioritizing the things that you need to take care of yourself. Don't wait until you're ill. And recognizing that we can't respond to all the things.
Sure.
We can't do all the things for all the people and be everything to everyone. I think that's, I hear from so many people, that they really struggle with that one, especially racialized leaders in the space mm-hmm. who have so much expectation placed on them around change. I think it's okay to be curious and to recognize when you uncover something, the work that we uncover is not always our work. It's somebody's work. But I think it's important to recognize that it's not always our work, and certainly not always our work to do alone.
In my culture, I think there's a saying that food is the sky. And so everybody depends on food as livelihood. It's what sustains us, but it's also so much more. It's our sense of identity. It's what connects us to previous generations, to grandfathers and grandparents we haven't met, and to our future.
That was Lillian Li Yin describing the significance food holds for her. Of East Asian descent, with roots in Taiwan and China, Lillian grew up with grandparents in the food and beverage industry. As she grew older, she began to see how food helps connect her to her family history and culture. Eventually, her passion for food and science led her to pursue a career as a registered dietitian. Today, Lillian works for the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority, supporting teens in a prenatal outreach program, as well as in a specialized clinic providing support around chronic disease management. In our conversation, Lillian reflects on what we heard from Paul and how food is so much more than the sum of its nutrients. And when we implement practices steeped in anti-fatness, weight bias, and discrimination, we ignore its broader value and significance.
So Paul and I talked about the statement that FoodShare has released on body liberation and fat acceptance, and how it's taking a stand against weight bias, weight stigma, fat phobia. And it really came out of being attuned to the needs of the community and mm-hmm. the requests that were coming into FoodShare that they saw as very harmful practices. How do you understand fat phobia, weight bias, weight stigma, and how have you seen them show up in the work that you do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, fat phobia, my exposure to that really came about when we were talking about fat acceptance and justice and people reclaiming what fat is mm-hmm. and kind of reshifting our understanding of that. We often see in media or in internalized bias that fat is a negative thing. There's so much negative connotation attached to it. Mm-hmm. But the way I talk to folks is, imagine if you had to stand or do your work or go on a walk without fat pads underneath your feet. How painful that would be. And so we all need fat. And fat is the basis of, or cholesterol is the basis of what forms our hormones, our signaling pathways. And that regulates our whole body with our appetite system, but also our mood and so many other things that allow us to function on a day-to-day basis. So fat is a very neutral thing. And it's the discrimination and the bias that perpetuate the harm and how that's perceived or how that's thought of. So stigma and weight stigma and discrimination to me is about those biases and how that comes into people's experiences and how that interplays with the way they receive care. So it could be, for example, on an individual level, when you're sitting down in a chair and depending on the size of the chairs, it could be uncomfortable for folks living in larger bodies and how that internalizes to validate that fat is not a good thing.
Right.
That it's my fault for being too fat. When we know that's not true. Or in the interface between healthcare providers and patients or individuals, I hear a lot of folks telling me, you know, I'm trying really hard to focus on health, not mm-hmm. weight. Which is a lot of the stance that dietitians are now really trying to encourage, that health not weight approach. And I get folks coming back to me saying, I'm trying really hard to do what we were talking about in our conversations, Lillian. But when I go back out there, I hear, you know, you got to move more. You got to eat less. I keep hearing those messaging. I keep getting weighed at my appointments and it makes it really hard for me to make progress in this. Mm. And so I think what Paul was speaking to is that stance of making it very clear about fat acceptance, that's all to put all of those things, that those harmful practices outside and leaning into what people need and want. And that's saying, you know, if my weight has nothing to do with whatever you're assessing at this appointment, maybe we don't get weighed. Or having those frank conversations about, well, how does this relate to my goals or my wants? And I think it's really important that we continue to have these conversations as care providers, because in medical science, there's been so much, and even in dietetics, it's rooted in colonial ways. And that approach, I think, has embedded in it, like BMI has taken off so much in medical science. And now we're starting to unlearn and undo some of that harm. But it takes time for systems to change. Unfortunately, though, each time an individual comes into contact with a healthcare provider and has a negative experience or experiences it in a punitive approach, as Paul mentioned, that's harm. And that creates distrust, or that perpetuates other issues. Like on the other spectrum of things, we see disordered eating or eating disorders. Mm-hmm. That's because of weight bias or discrimination, stereotypes.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? So what are the health harms of implementing practices that are steeped in weight bias and weight discrimination? So disordered eating, and then can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, our relationship with food and our identity and the way we navigate the world around us. Food is such an integral part of who we are as human beings. It connects people. It connects us through time and through space, right? Like we mentioned before, connecting us with our heritage and with our future generations. But also as you come into a new community, it's always, food is always there during celebration. It's such an integral part of who we are. And a lot of the times that weight bias and discrimination, it also devalues cultural feuds. It perpetuates false stereotypes. And that can cause a lot of harm in terms of our physical, emotional, mental well-being. When we think about our four aspects of self that I've been so privileged to have been taught by the Indigenous elders that I've had a chance to work with. And, you know, food connects all those four pieces, the mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual. There was one friend of mine who's a teacher in one of the local school boards, and she had posed a question during the pandemic to her 4-5 class of, what would you like to be? And a good handful of students said that they don't want to be fat. And hearing things like that breaks my heart, because it shows how pervasive and how harmful language is, media could be, and how much more work needs to be done. Because these are young folks navigating their identity, and it's happening in schools. And then you think about, well, who usually is experiencing so much more? And we think about household food insecurity and how that shapes the types of foods we have access to and our food environment and the policies that exist that support or don't support us in making choices like that. And so it shows that there's a lot of work to be done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I used to work in elementary schools as a public health nurse. I was on the school health team. And a lot of the work we would do would be around healthy eating, physical activity, mental wellness, kind of rooted in a health promotion framework. And just being in schools, we encountered a lot of instances where either classroom teachers or principals would actually engage in food policing of student lunches. And so the classroom teacher would go through each student's lunch and then tell them what they were allowed to eat and not eat. And so part of our conversations that we would be having in the schools is that what kinds of harms are we, you know, perpetuating when we're framing certain foods as bad, certain foods as good. And then we're not considering the larger systemic and contextual and cultural factors that shape what's in a student's lunch bag. So I think there's so many examples of things that we still need to be really working on and really talking about. Do you see tension in your practice between wanting to promote health and therefore people are talking about weight, and it's steeped in kind of that weight bias, weight stigma mm-hmm. type of language, and then also a movement towards this health, not weight, for example. Do you see that tension live out in the areas in which you're working?
Yeah, very much so. You know, even words like obesity and overweight.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear it from folks that live in larger bodies, two sides of things as well. And there's not one side of thing that is more valid than the other because it's their experience. But I've heard folks say, no, I want to be named. I want it because my experience of discrimination because of my chronic disease I'm living with has really impacted things. And the language affects my access to medication, to support, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas obesity and overweight, it has negative connotations. So a lot of folks I hear will say, well, you know, I don't like that term. It makes me feel gross.
So how do you navigate that? Is it based on the client's needs and wants with that respect?
I struggle a little bit working in this space, navigating that language myself.
Mm-hmm.
And when I reflect on this in the context of things, where I find most comfort is falling back onto, well, my duty as a care provider in doing no harm. If I just listen in, what is the language that they're most comfortable with? And sometimes asking open-ended questions, that really gets you the farthest with an individual. You know, asking, you know, we've got this much time together today. I'm here to support you around any of these things. What brings you to this office today? What brings you to this appointment? And a lot of the times, it's not so much about the weight, but it's around, well, I really struggle with nighttime eating, or I really struggle with emotional eating. And I'd like to build some more skills around that and navigating, you know, having some other coping skills. Maybe they don't have the language to describe exactly that, but that's often what I hear. And when I reframe it and I summarize what I'm hearing, they're like, yes, yeah, please. You know, coping with food is totally okay. But sometimes when we talk about like our toolbox in our home, if our body is our home and we've only got one tool in our toolbox, it can only get us so far before something else kind of happens. And we need to become familiar with a variety of tools. It mm-hmm. just really helps us in feeling more capable with dealing with a variety of different challenges that might come our way. So one thing that I really ensure I do when I chart, for example, is documenting things like we had a conversation around the importance of that health, not weight approach and their relationship with food. And so the rest of the team, they really begin to understand what it is that I'm doing with my time with the individual and the folks I'm serving
mm-hmm.
and understanding the context.
Okay.
Why are some of these things important? Because it has to do with that long-term health. And when you frame it that way, I think it resonates really well with the rest of the team, because at the end of the day, we're seeking improvements in health outcomes. However, if someone is always living in fear and they're calorie counting and they're stressed about what foods they can or cannot eat, or they're turning to food for comfort and that's their only coping mechanism, and we've shamed them for that, and how much harm that does and how little that actually improves their quality of life, I would say that we're failing in our work as healthcare providers and in our mission and our values. And so really understanding what it is we're trying to do when it comes to providing care, what does that really mean? And framing the language that way, I think resonates with other care providers in terms of what we're trying to do.
So 10 years down the road, for you, what does dietetics look like, feel like, sound like? What would you like it to look like, sound like, and feel like?
Like your favorite food that your grandmother cooked. You know, I think it feels wholesome. And that's how I described social justice, is that sense of wholesomeness. And I think our conversation today is very much about social justice.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes you feel warm. It feels right. everything just seems to fall in place. It's comforting, it's nourishing in all the ways, and it touches us in those four aspects of self we talked about, the physical, emotional, spiritual, and social. And it connects us through space and time.
It was such a pleasure to chat with Paul and Lillian. What they shared has important implications for the field of public health. A commitment to justice, including food justice, is critical to health and well-being. And our work in these areas needs to be driven by the needs of the communities with whom we work. When we assign value to foods based on their nutrients alone and focus unduly on body size and weight in the name of promoting health, we can do significant harm. Instead, we should pursue strategies that honor the dignity of every human being and advance the right to food that helps people thrive according to their needs.
Thanks for listening to Mind the Disruption, a podcast by the National Collaborating Center for Determinants of Health. Visit our website, nccdh.ca, to learn more about the podcast and our work. This episode has been produced by Carolina Jimenez, Bernice Yanfel, and me, Rebecca Schiff, with technical production and original music by Chris Perry. If you enjoyed this episode, tell a friend and subscribe. We have more stories on the way of people challenging the status quo to build a healthier, more just world.